From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is an update on the Exxon Valdez oil spill disaster in Prince William Sound. I'm Corey Flintoff. The Exxon spill has spread over 1,000 or more square miles of the sound. Consistently exceeding all efforts to estimate its magnitude, the spill has sent a black plume out into Blying Sound at the mouth of Resurrection Bay. Overflights this morning also confirmed that the spill has crossed Hinchinbrook Entrance and is sending tendrils to the east toward Cordova. Steve Heimel was on that overflight and filed this report.
The spill is so far out into the Gulf of Alaska that the reconnaissance flight had to turn back without finding the end of it. Rich Sundet does 2 reconnaissance flights a day and says it went past where the eye could see.
No, we always thought it was another big mass of oil beyond where we turned around. And I'd say we could see about 10 miles beyond what we saw, and it was still oil. It's probably the same stuff, heavy sheen and intermittent thick oil, fingers of oil.
The Department of Environmental Conservation is thinking about basing future reconnaissance work in Seward to track the spill in the Gulf of Alaska. At last report, the town of Seward was preparing for the onslaught of oil. The morning recon flight also confirmed earlier sightings of oil on Hinchinbrook Island to the east of Hinchinbrook Entrance. From the ways the streamers lie in the ocean, it's clear that currents are spreading the oil in all directions.
It just appears to be really weather. It's real difficult to see. It just appears to be a real old sheen, but along the coastline of Hinchinbrook there, you could see some really heavy fingers of heavy oil there.
So far, accounts of oil in Hawkins Cutoff are not confirmed. Our flight saw no oil there, though part of the eastern sound was fogged over. For APRN in Valdez, I'm Steve Heimel.
Up next, we have reporter Bob King on the line live from Valdez, where he's been attending a news conference with Governor Steve Cooper and some other political leaders of the state. Bob, what are they saying?
There are no major statements, really, from the governor today, Corey. The governor did stress the need to continue the cleanup, the existing structure. He said management structure might not be adequate, and where it's not, he said that the state would have to step in to help clean up more expeditiously. There was also talk about bringing in one of the state ferries to assist as housing and as a place to station state cleanup crews. But other than that, the governor had no major announcements at his press conference today.
It was just kind of a gesture of reassurance for the people in the area?
I think so, and a lot of people wanted reassurance, and they asked him many questions on a variety of topics, from local hire to the ELF question. People wanted to know what they thought, his impressions of this. Cooper's the tone of what the governor had to say was mainly reassuring. He did say that the oil industry's promises seemed to be empty. And when he spoke to the people, he said that he thought that he spoke in Alaskan terms. At one point, Danny Kelso actually described the state task force working on the problem as just a bunch of Alaskans putting together the ingenuity that we have, a line which drew a round of applause.
Thank you, Bob. That was Bob King reporting live from the governor's news conference in Valdez. That fisherman strike force designed by the state will start tomorrow morning with a coordinated oil skimming effort near Knight Island. Larry Dietrichs of the Department of Environmental Conservation outlined a plan whereby the state ferry Bartlett would moor in the northern area of Knight Island, where it'll house crews and equipment and repair shops, along with cleanup for oiled birds.
On board that vessel will be a 40-man cleanup crew. Each crew will have 2 skiffs with 2 persons on each skiff. They will pull booms around, collect oil. We will remove that oil from the water, put it into temporary storage containers. It will then be picked up by Exxon, who will provide some oil removal and storage capability. On board the vessel will be a biological team that will be able to take care of any critters that are collected during this recovery effort. We will be asking the contractor, who we will have on board to manage the cleanup teams, provide the equipment to do the cleanup. We're getting into a phase of cleanup that is the less glamorous part of an oil spill.
The Bartlett is en route from Cordova and will pick up more supplies in Valdez. The ferry Aurora will take over the job next week. Jack Lamb with Cordova Fishermen United urged patience for all fishermen and others who live in Prince William Sound. The word of the day, he said, is wait.
That sounds like a lousy word to use, but we need to take time. This is going to be here a long time. The effort that it's going to take to clean this up is going to take a long time. And when I say wait, everybody goes, and I can understand that. Believe me, I can. I mean, the frustration level gets up just about this level here, and all you want to do is head to the surface and do some screaming. But we've got to keep this thing working. It's working now. It's going to be working better. This is something the size and the magnitude of which we've never tried to deal with before. The fishermen were ready from almost hour one, and we sat and sat and sat. I mean, I know what the frustration is about. So I'm speaking from the experience that we've had to deal with and the frustration that we've had to deal with. I'm sure that vehicles are going to be set up in which your willingness to participate can be addressed and can be adapted into what we're doing. But it's got to be done in a systematic manner, or else it's going to get so chaotic out there that the success rate is going to go down.
Jack Lamb of Cordova Fishermen United. At a meeting today in Cordova, State Fish and Game Commissioner Don Collinsworth outlined a damage assessment plan that'll coordinate the efforts of his department, the National Marine Fisheries Service, and the University of Alaska. Brian Mann has a report.
The Department of Fish and Game's Don Collinsworth has today outlined the organization which will be responsible for damage assessment in Prince William Sound. In a meeting at Fish and Game headquarters in Cordova only an hour ago, Collinsworth described the cooperation between the University of Alaska, the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, and the National Marine Fisheries Service from the federal government. In charge of the operation will be a sort of tribunal, he says, headed up by himself, Steve Penoyer, the National Marine Fisheries Service, and Vera Alexander for the university. There's already a trace of disagreement over the plan, however, coming from Ricky Ott with the Cordova District Fishermen's United. She objected to the tentative appointment of Dr. David Shaw as the university's field manager in the project. Ott refused to comment on why she'd raised the objection to the appointment, but stated that she'd be meeting with university officials in the next few days. According to Commissioner Collinsworth, the project, which is now underway, is the first leg of what will be the long process of sorting out impact from last week's spill. Timelines under discussion were ranging from 3 to 5 years. Collinsworth says the sensitive sampling project they've begun, examining fish, water, and the seabed, won't rely on volunteers. He says, quote, the results of our work is perhaps going to have to withstand judicial challenge. Of course, what we're looking for in the long term is some kind of reparations from the oil company. Everything we do has to be done with a very secure, rigid methodology. When asked how many people they'll be moving into Cordova, Collinsworth wouldn't give an exact number, but stated that double-wide trailers were being brought in for housing. As personnel arrive from around the state, the commissioner says his department will be back hiring to fill positions in other parts of Alaska, positions usually devoted this time of year to management, research, and enhancements in other parts of Alaska. Collinsworth says he doesn't have a blank check on these projects, but, quote, the governor wants this job done. Asked if he's had contact with the people from Exxon, Commissioner Collinsworth says no, but indicated that he may be flying back to the nation's capital sometime next week. The purpose? To see about upfront funding from the oil companies for damage assessment projects now underway. In Cordova, I'm Brian Mann.
Cordova fishermen say the Exxon spill disaster might never have happened if the industry had complied with the settlement of an early lawsuit over the matter. Bob King reports.
In 1975, the Cordova District Fishermen's Union, CDFU, filed a lawsuit against the Alyeska Pipeline Company for the lack of an environmental impact statement for the tanker traffic through Prince William Sound. Spokeswoman Michelle Hahn O'Leary says they won that lawsuit, but Congress issued a variance with certain conditions.
With the stipulation that Alyeska have double-hulled American tankers, had multiple radar stations all the way out through Hinchinbrook Entrance, or to Hinchinbrook Entrance, and also that they had a pilot on board to Hinchinbrook Entrance.
The CDFU's Michelle Hahn O'Leary says if any one of those stipulations had been complied with, the Exxon Valdez accident might not have been the disaster it has turned out to be. The CDFU is not sure why the stipulations were ignored. They say the change in pilot requirements may have been due to a boarding accident on the exposed waters of Hinchinbrook Entrance. Anna Leary says she's not sure now what the fishermen's group plans to do to see that the original stipulations are met, but she's hoping for help from the state.
We've been fighting all the way along through this to try to secure our fisheries and our livelihood, and it's frankly been very difficult. I'm sure that the state will be taking the ball here and following through, seeing what Exxon's failures may have been.
Michelle Han O'Leary with the Cordova District Fishermen's Union. In Valdez, I'm Bob King.
Commentator John Howe spent a month in Prince William Sound a couple of years ago. Here are some of his observations.
Last night, a week after the wreck of the good ship Exxon Valdez, having successfully navigated the early stages of mourning, anger, denial, guilt, I realized I had entered the final stage when sorrow turns to prayer. So I got out my Prince William Sound journal, and I searched through it for memories of the wild creatures I'd seen there. August 20th, 1986. This morning we took the skiff up a tide channel into an inner salt lagoon with a salmon stream at its head. As we pushed slowly up the channel, a harbor seal streaked by underwater, not rising to look back at us until it was almost around the first bend. The stream was about 30 feet wide and almost solid with salmon, no more than a few inches between any two of them all the way across. Farther up, the forest closed in around white sandbars in deep, purest emerald green pools teeming with fish. From high up on the bank, from deep devil's club and ferns and low overhanging hemlock boughs came the loud snorting woof of a bear, then the sound of brush crashing and a glimpse of brown fur moving fast up the mountain. August 27th, Montague Island. Slow drizzle all day. Saw a Steller's Jay so wet its blue was soaked too dark to see. Many bedraggled eagles lurking on snags over the water. A fox sparrow, kingfishers, and a sharp-shinned hawk. All day the eerie squawks and whistles and whirrings of thousands of seabirds, mostly murres and murrelets, floated through the mist across still water dappled by rain. August 29th, Night Island. Killer whales. 42 animals spread out over a half square mile, two pods traveling together. An extended family? A tribe? I learned last night that each pod in Prince William Sound speaks its own dialect of the killer whale language. September 4th. Early evening in a small cove near Simpson Bay. Golden light glows through the feathers of a gull gliding by close overhead. Salmon leap, fall back with soft smacks on the water, crystal clear water, deepest blue. A cone-shaped avenue of light expands out across the water, flows sparkling toward snow-capped mountains and the setting sun. Floating asleep on her back, her pup held tightly in her arms, a mother sea otter drifts gently towards us on an incoming tide. September 9th. This morning, from a small rocky island across from Columbia Glacier, we watched an oil tanker slide out of Valdez Narrows. It was one of those scenes Alaskans take pride in. Straight-lined, gleaming, metal, confident 20th-century technology moving through a magnificent Alaska landscape. A fine scene to show anyone who doubts that oil development can happen here. We can drill for oil at the mouth of Bristol Bay. We can explore for oil in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. Watching the tanker move so purposefully, so dutifully out to sea, for a brief moment, I believed. I'll admit it, I bought the party line. It can't happen here, not in this perfect place.
You're listening to the Alaska Public Radio Network. Alaska Public Radio Network, this is an update on the Exxon Valdez oil spill disaster in Prince William Sound. I'm Corey Flintoff. Governor Steve Cooper assured fishermen that oil spill plans will be strengthened and that they'd be compensated for their losses stemming from the Exxon spill. Bob King reports on the governor's news conference in Valdez.
Governor Steve Cooper told a large crowd gathered at the Valdez Civic Center that he would take strict action if the Alyeska Terminal's oil spill contingency plans were not strengthened.
There's going to be a much better plan. There's going to have to be absolute proof that the equipment's in place, that the personnel are there and properly trained. There's going to have to be periodic drills, and probably a lot of other things, too. That will be done by the pipeline company. We're authorized to do that, and if it isn't done, we're authorized to close the pipeline.
Turning his attention to the many fishermen in the crowd, Cooper promised to press for a fair and fast compensation plan from Exxon.
We don't want anybody to think that they have to hire a lawyer and go into federal court and sue the largest corporation in America. We want to put a system together that will allow you who are suffering damages, the fishermen and other people in this area, to bring to us a fairly simple set of proof of whatever you lose, and we want you to be paid quickly and expeditiously.
Cooper also pledged that the state would cooperate with Exxon and the Coast Guard in the continuing cleanup, adding, though, when we disagree, we'll do it ourselves. With the spill response now entering its newest phase, the long and tedious work of cleaning up the beaches, Cooper assured the audience that the matter would not be forgotten once the outside television crews have packed up and gone home.
No way. Let me tell you what. The whole world is watching Exxon's response on this one. The Congress is watching it. Foreign governments are watching it. The state of Alaska sure as hell is watching it. And there's no way that this is going to get swept under the rug.
In Valdez, I'm Bob King.
The hulk of the Exxon Valdez continues to totter on a ridge of Bly Reef. Oil is still streaming from many of the rents in the vessel. But Exxon says most of the oil remaining in the ship's compartments will soon be removed. Steve Heimel reports.
Exxon claims to have pumped more than three-quarters of the remaining oil out of the damaged tanker. The salvage company will have the job of sealing enough tanks to keep the tanker buoyant and floating it off Bly Reef. The high tides to do that are on their way in this week, but that also means low tides are on the way in, which could subject the vessel to stresses. The first minus tide goes out Monday evening. The target high tide is Wednesday. The destination of the hulk is still not known, though an apparent agreement among the three parties running the operation, the Coast Guard, the Department of Environmental Conservation, and Exxon, would keep the tanker out of Port Valdez. DEC Commissioner Dennis Kelso says it will go to some area that's already been hit by the oil.
Three sites, not including Valdez Harbor, are currently under consideration. One of the factors that we have asked Exxon to consider, and I think they would want to consider on their own, is how to avoid the risk of additional pollution. And so we have suggested, along with the Coast Guard, I believe, that sites that have already been oiled be considered as possible temporary repair sites. Exxon is still considering that. They have more discussion to do. We'll be offering our views along with the Coast Guard and the operations group. I don't have that information. I believe that the sites that I have seen that Exxon is considering were on Naked Island. Are all three, Larry? All three of the potential anchorages are on Naked Island.
The notion of doing the salvage on Naked Island surprised some scientists working the spill because, in fact, they're hopeful some parts of that island were only lightly exposed and are going to recover. The oil itself is settling in. A large plume of it is on its way into the Gulf of Alaska. Heavy concentrations are sitting along the east side of Night Island. Oil has washed off on Latouche Island quite extensively and has worked its way into Latouche Passage on the way to the hatchery site at Sawmill Bay. At last report, booms were still holding that oil. One spot of good news is the repeated sightings of oil on Hinchinbrook Island appear to be unfounded. The scum that was seen and taken for aging oil is more likely a natural algae bloom, according to Dave Shaw and Peter McRoy of the University of Alaska Fairbanks.
David and I flew out there this morning on a helicopter, and we could see these brown lines, but it resembles oil in a way, but we thought it was natural. Wouldn't you agree, David?
Yeah, the texture was slightly different in color, and it didn't have the tendency to go from sheens to slicks the way we were observing with the oil. So it, based on that visual observation and the kind of theoretical past observations, we're pretty skeptical right now until that really is oil over there.
skeptical was mild compared to the reaction of Exxon. There was a good deal of concern because nobody could see how the oil got across Hinchinbrook entrance. Samples of the scum were taken by the Fish and Game Department just to make sure. Both members of the recon crew that made the report also returned to the site and actually tasted the water, and they now agree the scum on Hinchinbrook is not oil. Those working on the spill got confirmation yesterday of their suspicion that this cleanup is not going to be easy. A weathering study on Alaska North Slope crude oil by scientist Jim Payne indicates it's formed a jelly-like mousse that will stay congealed like that for at least a year. The material is very difficult to scoop up. For APRN and Valdez, I'm Steve Heimel.
Up and running. That's how organizers in Cordova are describing their efforts to save otters and seabirds caught on the oil-soaked beaches of Prince William Sound. Three seiners are out already with crews on shore carrying nets and towels. Three more boats are heading out today. Brian Mann reports from Cordova.
Jim Merritt is a gill netter and skipper of the Silver Bullet. Kelly Weberting is a bookseller. Together they've organized a rescue operation aimed at saving as many otter and seafowl as possible. They returned to Cordova last night after days of wading the filthy beaches, both men obviously tired but also excited by their mission. They described tide pools, calf deep in crude oil. Hip waders are standard protection, Merritt says. They met last night with the skippers of three new boats, who today will join the effort. According to Weaverting, this operation got underway with a focus on birds. Workers set out to clean the worst of the gunk from gulls and other fowl, clearing their nasal passages and feeding them liquid solutions to build their strength. As the bird rescue got underway, however, they began seeing otter too. In all conscience, Weaverting says, we couldn't just leave them. Both Merritt and Weaverting described this as the hardest and the most rewarding work they've ever done. There will be up times and down times, Weaverting says. We're going to have some failures. One of the otter we collected died overnight. Officially, these men are working for Exxon. Exxon is reportedly paying for both manpower and boats. When the oil company or state and federal agencies are mentioned, however, they respond with a trace of disdain. We don't see them out there, Weaverting says. It's total chaos. But we organized this, and it's a system that's working. After the birds and otter are collected from the beaches, a boat is ferrying them on to Valdez. There, they'll be cleaned, and with a little luck, eventually set free. In Cordova, I'm Brian Mann.
This coverage of the Exxon Valdez oil spill disaster is made possible by the member stations of APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is an update on the Exxon Valdez oil spill disaster in Prince William Sound. I'm Corey Flintoff. The long black tongue of oil thrust into the Gulf of Alaska by the Exxon disaster is showing some signs of breaking up, but it's still carrying an enormous amount of oil, and it's still spreading. The cleanup operations went into high gear today on calm seas under clear skies. Exxon, still pumping oil from the stricken tanker as it teeters on Bligh Reef, says there's now less oil aboard the vessel than there is on the water. They say that reduces fears of another massive spill if there's more damage to the tanker from increasing tidal action. Steve Heimel has an update.
At a 4 o'clock news conference, Exxon was expected to say only about 150,000 barrels of oil remain aboard the hull. Pumps are losing some of their efficiency as the oil sloshes around in the bottom of the tanks. The company hopes to have the tanker pumped out Tuesday and afloat by Wednesday's high tide. The outflow into the Gulf of Alaska extends about 60 miles. Winds are pushing it further out to sea, and a morning radar flight by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's side-looking radar shows that the leading edge of the spill may be breaking up in the current south of Resurrection Bay. That oil is far offshore. The State Ferry Bartlett arrived at the San Juan Fish Hatchery today. Oil is threatening the booms put out by fishermen there, and some has spilled over, according to spill cleanup coordinator Jim Hayden.
We should be very worried about San Juan. We need to keep the hydrocarbons out of the bay, even at low levels. We need to keep them out, and it's critical. The fisheries people are, I understand, going to be doing some remote releases of the fry.
The midday reconnaissance flights reported the amount of oil over the booms to be just a sheen. Workers from the Bartlett are taking up oil along the edge of the booms.
The personnel there for the state, for the contractor, and for Exxon should be commended for today's effort.
The animal rehabilitation effort attracted a flood of volunteers today in Valdez, and also a virtual river of toweling donated from across the state. For APRN in Valdez, I'm Steve Heimel.
Cleaning and caring for the birds and sea otters being brought into Valdez is a huge and labor-intensive operation. It takes hours to wash and dry the animals, not to mention coaxing distressed creatures to eat. Marilyn Dudley from SeaWorld in San Diego is on the otter rescue team. She says otters eat a quarter of their body weight every day and will quickly weaken if they don't get regular feedings.
Unfortunately, a lot of these animals, we don't know how long they've been oiled. They've lost an incredible amount of weight. For a sea otter, it only takes a matter of 48 hours before it loses enough weight where it could be critically ill. So we're just trying to get them the oil off of them. We're trying to just get them fed up and, back on their flippers again. But it may be a matter of, several days to several weeks for some of them.
It takes an hour to wash an oiled bird. Veterinarian Jessica Porter is with the Bird Rescue Research Center in Berkeley. She says she uses a mixture of the dishwashing liquid Dawn and very warm water to bathe the birds, always keeping an eye out for those who are likely to bite.
The birds with the sharp beaks that want to bite you are the ones that are going to bite you because they're not sedate by nature. They're very flighty. And then we have birds that are not, they don't try to bite you, and they're fairly sedate, but they just want to curl up and die. They just succumb to the stress. One of the things you have to worry about when you're dealing with these birds is watching for signs that they're just going to stress out and die. And sometimes you have to stop completely, wrap them up in a towel, and put them away in a dark, quiet box just to save their lives, and then go back after they've coped with that stress a little bit better, and then go back and start washing them again.
Exxon is picking up the tab for the cleaning of the birds and sea otters. Cleanup efforts based in Cordova are moving ahead as quickly as they can, but spokespeople there say the efforts being slowed by poor communications with Exxon. Brian Mann has more.
We're getting boats and people out there as quickly as we can. Those are the words of Michelle Hahn O'Leary, a member of Cordova District Fishermen United's Executive Board of Directors. CDFU has 50 boats and around 90 people on the water, according to O'Leary, working to protect hatcheries like the San Juan and other sensitive areas around the sound. That effort is hampered, she says, by poor communications with Exxon, the oil company responsible for picking up the tab. We're in need of a senior vice president in Cordova to sign checks, she says. We're having difficulty keeping the lines of communication open so we can get quick and immediate money for equipment. Equipment includes booming material and supplies for people in the field. Currently, Exxon is represented on this side of the sound by a claims office, staffed by two men brought in from out of state. They refused to speak on the record, but did say they expected a liaison office to open here next week. The attitude towards Exxon in Cordova varies from negative to extremely negative. Negligent and absolutely callous were adjectives used by Rocky Estes, a fisherwoman with the Roxy Foxy. Senator Mike Szymanski, who traveled through Cordova today with Senator Jay Kurtula, summed up the mood with this statement, quote, "I think this is a turning point in history. I certainly don't trust the oil companies, and it'll be a long time before I will be able to trust them again," end quote. Meanwhile, a town meeting this afternoon brought Cordova fishermen together for the first time with an attorney who will be handling joint claims against Exxon. That meeting was closed to the press, and also to any fishermen already represented by another attorney. That meant at least two boat owners being turned away at the door. In Cordova, I'm Brian Mann.
Meanwhile, outside of Prince William Sound, preparations are underway to deal with oil that's drifting westward. Sheens of oil have been sighted off Cape Resurrection at the mouth of Resurrection Bay. Both the Port of Seward and Park Service officials from Kenai Fjords National Park are preparing for it. APRN's Sue Burris is on the line with us now from Seward. Sue, what are you seeing there?
There's about 2 miles of brand new bright orange plastic containment boom laying beside the Seward Harbor. They're planning to deploy it this afternoon just as a practice deployment. It's interesting stuff. The plastic has black floats attached to it at intervals and a heavy chain along the bottom. And there's the big cardboard shipping cartons and plastic packing material is all still stacked right nearby. It's brand new.
You say there's about 2 miles. That, frankly, doesn't sound like very much.
That's what the city of Seward has been able to purchase. Right now, the National Park Service incident response team is inventorying the places that will be used. The city of Seward, of course, has first priority if the oil would start to threaten Resurrection Bay. But if it goes on by towards Kenai Fjords National Park, then the Park Service is setting the priorities on where that boom would be placed. They're ordering more also.
Does that mean, though, that if it does come that way, that they're expecting that they're going to have to sacrifice some places in favor of others?
Yeah. If it comes toward into Kenai Fjords National Park, they know that they're not going to be able to save every place. What they're doing right now is setting the priorities of what will be first and what will be next. There's a list of about 10 places. And they're inventorying, right now they're inventorying the wildlife and the vegetation in the area so that essentially they'll know what they've lost if it goes that far.
Thank you. That's Sue Burris reporting from Seward. This special update on the Exxon Valdez disaster is brought to you by the member stations of APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is a special update on the Exxon Valdez oil spill disaster. I'm Corey Flintoff. The Alyeska Pipeline Service Company has yet to respond to the state emergency order tightening up its oil spill contingency plan. The order, signed yesterday, gives Alyeska until Monday to respond. Spokesman Tom Brennan says the company will have all the equipment necessary to comply on hand by Monday. The changes ordered by the state include a round-the-clock 12-person response crew, regular booming of all tankers upon arrival at the Valdez oil terminal, a 2-tugboat escort all the way to the Hinchinbrook entrance to Prince William Sound, and state-of-the-art equipment in position to reach a spill anywhere in the sound within 2 hours. Coast Guard Admiral Edward Nelson says President Bush's call for a greater federal role in the spill cleanup will have no major impact on the operations in Prince William Sound, at least for the moment. Peter Kenyon reports.
Speaking to reporters this afternoon, the plainspoken admiral said he's already in charge of the steering committee that includes Exxon Shipping President Frank Iarossi and DEC Commissioner Dennis Kelso, and the president's comments won't change that.
By popular vote, I guess I was named the chairman of this. It's like being elected to the PTA.
Nelson said the White House didn't consult with him before the president made his announcement that troops would be heading for Prince William Sound. He said Transportation Secretary Skinner and Coast Guard Commandant Yost will join the command structure, but Yost won't get here for a week to 10 days. Meanwhile, the Department of Defense is assessing what military hardware and or personnel may be needed to combat the spill. Lieutenant General Thomas McInerney from Elmendorf Air Force Base is leading that effort, but Nelson says so far they don't need much of anything.
There's no point in bringing a lot of material down, have it sit someplace not ready to be used. And we've got plenty of material. We've got a lot of material in.
That goes for military personnel, too, says Nelson. But he says Exxon plans to hire an additional 500 workers by the end of next week, all of them Alaskans. Starting tomorrow, Vico, on contract to Exxon, will be stationing a boat housing 90 workers off Naked Island to begin phase one of beach cleanup efforts. Exxon's Andrew Teal gave a very cautious assessment of the shore cleaning activities. He said the chances of compounding the damage to the environment are high if the crews aren't extremely careful. High-pressure water cleaning, for example, could wipe out all life in the fragile tide pools along the shore. And if used on sand or gravel beaches, it could drive the oil down into the beach instead of removing it. Meanwhile, Coast Guard Commander Steve McCall says some fairly low-tech efforts are now underway to try and break up the leading edge of the slick, now approaching Kodiak Island. McCall says herring seiners from Togiak are dragging their small mesh herring nets through the slick, and Coast Guard cutters are plowing through the crude in an attempt to manually disperse the oil. Nelson says a request to use chemical dispersants is on his desk, but no decision has been made. There's some concern that at this point the crude is so weathered that chemicals would not be effective, and the chemicals could harm marine life. For APRN in Valdez, I'm Peter Kenyon.
Part of the focus of attention on the spill is shifting westward to the Kenai Peninsula, Cook Inlet, and Kodiak. Reporter Bruce Melzer's in Seward, where officials have laid their defenses and are now watching the long windrows of oil as they snake past. We spoke with Bruce this afternoon about how things stand in Seward.
Seward seems to be different than Valdez. Seward has had time to prepare for this. About 10 days ago, the National Park Service activated a multi-agency incident team. The National Park Service took the leadership because it controls so much of the land around here, especially the Kenai Fjords National Park. And the way the Park Service tells it, they got together with the community and decided which salmon streams and coves would be boomed off, kind of where they would fight the fight. And that appears to be what's happened. They've boomed off a handful of coves. They're going to boom off another one today. And they're prepared to stand their ground there. The one thing they do say is that to kind of fight the battle by these coves and streams, they're going to need skimmers and boats. And so far, those have not arrived. In part, they're counting on Exxon for those.
Well, has the oil actually come into Resurrection Bay so far?
No, not really. I was talking with Mayor Don Gilman, and it has not turned the corner, as they say, and kind of come down the bay. It has hit some of the islands on the outside of Resurrection Bay, Fox Island and some of the headlands there, but it has not come into Resurrection Bay, and fortunately enough, it has not hit the Kenai National Park, Kenai Fjords National Park.
Now, looking a little farther along, the newspaper reports this morning were saying that the oil is bound for Cook Inlet now. What are you hearing there?
Well, National Park people are convinced that that's going to happen. They're already making plans to start work in Katmai National Park and also Lake Clark National Park, which are on right on Cook Inlet. They are doing the same sort of process that they did here in Seward. They go over and try and count animals and sort of take a survey of things so that when the oil strikes, if the oil strikes, in essence, they can do a body count when it's over. And the National Parks Director for Alaska, Boyd Everson, assures me that they're going to hand Exxon the bill for this whole thing when it's over, both the bill for the incident team and also if there's any way to assess the damage, Exxon's going to get that bill also.
Reporter Bruce Melzer in Seward. Homer is now the headquarters for the Lower Cook Inlet response to the oil spill. Joe Gallagher reports.
An old Homer restaurant that's been out of business for a while has been transformed into Command Central. The walls are covered with maps that are being used to chart the flow of the oil. The latest report has the leading edge of the oil off of Gore Point near the tip of the Kenai Peninsula. The fear in this area is that the slick will be picked up by currents in Kennedy Entrance and flushed into Cook Inlet and Kachemak Bay. The emergency response team has been busy trying to organize materials and personnel. It's a somewhat tedious task that has resulted in meetings that have been going on since 8 o'clock this morning. One thing that has been made clear is that the protection of the Tutka Bay hatchery, where millions of pink salmon fry are released each spring, will get top priority. Fish and game biologist Nick Dudiak.
We deployed an additional 1,200-foot experimental curtain yesterday. We're testing that out. We're getting in another 1,000-foot of inflatable boom today that we'll be putting out on the spit for use at the hatchery or other areas as needed. And we've also got another 5,000-foot of boom that we had special made for us in California, and trying to work with the MAC team here to get it shipped up via the Air Reserve or National Guard or whatever method we can. And hopefully we will be able to deploy that early next week.
What other areas of Kachemak Bay and Cook Inlet will be boomed off and protected is hard to say. Biologists flew over the area this afternoon and are expected to come up with a plan later today. Homer Mayor John Calhoun says it's hard to make any decisions at this time.
As you can see from being at the meetings, it's a very dynamic situation, and it's hard to really come up with an equation that says this is what's going to happen and this is when it's going to happen. And as a result, I think, you know, a lot of this just has to be handled as it comes up, with the most amount of preparedness you can give. Whether or not we are prepared or whether the group is totally prepared depends on how true these things fall out of what we think is going to happen.
Homer Mayor John Calhoun. Reporting from Homer, I'm Joe Gallagher.
Kodiak is breathing a little easier today as the progress of the oil slick seems to have slowed. But the weather forecast is not favorable, and the island continues preparations to protect critical areas. Charlene Parent has details.
Patches of oil sheen are about 30 miles northeast of Marmot Island. But according to Coast Guard Commander Ed Page, the closest oil with any threat to Kodiak is about 90 miles away. Page says Kodiak is in a fairly good position with time to proceed with protective booming.
Should that oil arrive, and there is always that potential, and the oil that we saw anyway, it's something we could manage, something we could handle. I'm not going to be overconfident and say it's not going to hit us, but what I'm left with is that we have time and we should proceed with what we're doing.
The organization of preventive efforts continues. 11 fishing vessels have been deployed north to a Fognak Island to protect Katoy, Paul's, and Portage Bays. The state trooper vessel Wolstad and Coast Guard vessel Storis are on scene to supply boom, and log booms are under construction. Other containment materials are being shipped in, and more fishing vessels stand ready to go when needed. The Fish and Wildlife Department is in the process of surveying the Kodiak Archipelago. Seven crews are on a Fognak now collecting data on the wildlife. That's the good news. The bad news is the weather forecast for this weekend. Bob Bonner of the National Weather Service says Kodiak can expect east-northeast winds starting Sunday, which would help push the oil this way. But it's still a question just what kind of impact the oil will have on Kodiak. Commander Page.
There's always that potential that a large slug, so to speak, or a large mass of oil may escape Prince William Sound down the road. I'm sure it will, for that matter. And if the conditions were just right, if the wind and the weather were mild enough to but in the right direction and move in this area and let that mass stay relatively intact, then we've got a serious problem again.
But Commander Page says the oil has a long way to travel and a lot can happen in that period of time. Reporting from Kodiak, I'm Charlene Parent.
Planning is in progress for a memorial service in Anchorage later this month to help people deal with their grief over the damage caused by the oil spill. It's scheduled for Saturday afternoon, April 23rd, and it'll include a period for silent thought, some poetry, and some music. Singer-songwriter Libby Roderick composed a chorus to share with people at the event. She and violinist Mari Jameson performed it for us this afternoon.
Give me the sound of the otters. Give me the sound of the gulls overhead. Give me the sound of her waters. The sound we will never forget. Give me the sound of the otters. Give me the sound of the gulls overhead. Give me the sound of her waters. The sound we will never forget. Listen to the sound of human hearts. Listen to them breaking on the reef. Listen to the sound of human hearts. Forgive us, help us heal. Listen to the sound of human hearts. Listen to them breaking on the shore. Forgive us, help us heal. Breaking on the reef. Listen to the sound of human hearts. Forgive us, help us heal. Listen to the sound of human hearts. Listen to them breaking on the shore. Forgive us, help us heal. Give me the sound. Give me the sound never forget. The sound we will never forget. The sound we will never forget.
A Chorus for Prince William Sound, composed by Libby Roderick and performed with violinist Mari Jameson.
This special coverage is made possible by contributions from concerned Alaskan listeners and by the member stations of the Alaska Public Radio Network.